Hey everyone, Yannick Silver here, internetlifestyle.com and maverickbusinessadventures.com. Really looking forward to the call today. I have with me Chip Conley, who Sir Richard Branson calls a fellow rebel entrepreneur. that's always a good that's a good thing. And whose new book, Peak, has been getting rave reviews from the likes of Guru Stephen Covey, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, Longtails, Chris Anderson, and former Medtronic CEO and True North author Bill George, among others. And I'm one of the other. I'm one of the others who has been raving about the book too. I picked it up. I don't know, on the suggestion of I guess our mutual friend Christine Comfort Lynch, and I just really loved it and sent it to everyone involved in my new organization. By way of background, Chip is the founder and CEO of Joie de Vie Hospitality, California's largest boutique hotel company and America's number two. Starting out at the age of 26 with virtually no industry experience, he opened his first hotel, the Phoenix, in San Francisco's edgy Tenderloin District on a wing and a prayer. And the company now consists of over 40 award-winning hotels, restaurants, and spas across the state. And each unique property is designed to produce what Chip calls identity refreshment. We'll get into that for sure for his guests. And the company gleans inspiration for each hotel from popular magazines such as Rolling Stone, which is the Phoenix, the New Yorker for his Hotel Rex, Real Simple Meets Dwell for his Hotel Vital, and Wired is Hotel Avant, or is that Avante?
Avante.
Okay, Avante, sorry. And so Chip and his company's time-tested techniques have been featured in Inc., People, Time, Wall Street Journal, all kinds of publications, and his new best-selling book, Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow, is what we're going to be talking about today. So Chip, you there?
Yes.
All
good
right.
To be here. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm excited. Anything you want to throw in as far as the intro beyond that?
No. It's you know, I think I'm hoping today that I can. I'm not a consultant or a professor. I'm not someone who has a business theory. I'm trying to make an hourly wage on. I'm a guy who, you know, has my own company and what I learned in a downturn, a very difficult time post 9/11 is what I wrote about and the theory that came from it, and so we can talk about it today.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited. Like I said, as soon as I read the book, I knew that I'd love to get you on the line and pick your brain a little bit. And something I should mention is you've received numerous top hospitality industry awards, honored by San Francisco Business Times as 2007's most admired CEO in innovation. So, you know, a somewhat modest guy by not bringing up any of that stuff. Also a YPO member, so you've done a lot of great stuff.
Thank you.
So let's get into Maslow. How did you find influence and inspiration in Maslow's hierarchy of needs? And maybe just for people, just a quick fundamental on that hierarchy of needs.
Sure. As just a background, I started the company about 21 years ago. So with that first hotel. And
the Phoenix,
yeah. Which is it's a 1950s motel in the ghetto. I mean, it wasn't a great real estate purchase, but it became a big success and a rock and roll hotel with lots of celebrities staying there. And the company grew from there. And 15 years later, we were the largest hotelier in Northern California, and we had 20 hotels around the Bay Area. We're about double that size now. But that was 15 years later was 2001. And in essence, in 2001, the hotel market fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, and all of our hotels were in the Bay Area, and the Bay Area was the worst hit part of the nation, post-dot-com bust and post-9/11. So we were very vulnerable, and I was at a stage where I wasn't taking a salary. I wasn't getting a lot of joie de vivre, which means joy of life. And I went into a local bookstore, and I was in the self-help section of the bookstore looking for something, looking for a clue. And I came across Abraham Maslow, and it reminded me, I saw it, and I said, I remember this guy from college and from business school. I went to both, you know, college and business school at Stanford. And I was reminded of his hierarchy of needs and what Abraham Maslow is most famous for. He's a guy who was a psychologist in the U.S. And was well known between the 1940s and 1960s. He died in 1970. But what he was most famous for was this thing called the hierarchy of needs, and it was an approach to thinking about human motivation and what we're here on Earth for. And it was based upon the premise that most psychologists prior to that had looked at worst practices in human behavior and defined the human psyche based upon that.
Right.
And Maslow said, what if we studied people who were high performers, highly fulfilled, and learned from them? And he created this hierarchy of needs pyramid with 5 levels to it. And the basic idea was people have physiological needs at the base of the pyramid, and once those are mostly met, they move up to the next level of the pyramid, which are their safety needs. And once their safety needs are met, they start focusing a little bit more on their social belonging needs, which is the 3rd level. And the 4th level was their esteem needs, how they have sense of self-esteem based upon how they see themselves in the world. And at the top of the pyramid, the peak of the Maslow hierarchy of needs pyramid, was the idea of self-actualization, which the best way for me to describe what self-actualization means is to just remind you of what the U.S. Army used as an ad campaign for 15 years, which was, remember?
Be all that you can be.
Be all you can be, which the U.S. Army literally got from Maslow. The U.S. Army had a division of the Army that actually studied Maslow, strangely enough.
Well, now they're an army of one. Which
now they're an army of one. I don't know. Yeah. I'm not sure who they studied for that. But probably Donald Trump. So I think that the idea of being all you could be was, appealed to me, of course, at a time when things were difficult. But what I really liked about Maslow was he was really speaking to the idea that, we all have base needs in life, but as your life gets better, you start focusing on these higher needs. And I guess that's what I needed as my own little, message of hope during that time. But what became clear to me very quickly was the idea of the hierarchy of needs behind it is the idea that humans have motivations. And I started looking at this and saying, wow, couldn't we use the hierarchy of needs and apply it to our relationship with the 3 most dominant constituencies we have, which are employees, customers, and investors. And that's what we did.
To really try and take it beyond just loyalty with customers and beyond just loyalty with employees, but really bring them into their peak experiences.
Well, what it was the idea that, generally speaking, in what different, companies that do well are companies that create loyalty,
mm-hmm,
with customers and employees and even with investors, but they're also companies that differentiate themselves. And what became clear to me about Maslow and the hierarchy of needs is that what's at the base of the pyramid are physiological and safety needs. Excuse me. They're in many ways very common amongst all of us. And as you move up that pyramid, fewer people move up the pyramid, and there's a small fraction of the world that actually is in a self-actualized state. So I started thinking, well, if humans can aspire to self-actualization, why can't companies? Why can't you create a company that's sort of a self-actualized company that helps its employees and its customers be all they can be? We'll get very specific about this soon because it sounds, like a bunch of marketing
right.
jargon. But the reality is that that was where we were in 2001 when we said let's actually, instead of doing what most companies do in a downturn, which is you get into this fear mode and you get into this cost slashing mode, which we did some of also, of course. We really instead said, okay, let's make sure that we get our survival needs met, at the base of the pyramid, but let's focus on these higher needs, because what will differentiate us as a company in the downturn is the idea that we're not just focusing on these base survival needs, but we're focusing on how do you create self-actualization for employees, customers, and investors.
Okay, well, let's start and jump into some specific examples. Let's start with customers, I guess. That's probably
sure.
Definitely a core group. Or did you start with employees? Where was your first thinking?
Let's start with employees. And,
okay.
And the reason I say that is because we're in the service business, and frankly, if your employees are not happy, your customers will feel it.
Great.
So if you going back to that the five levels of the pyramid, you've got physiological and safety needs are the two base levels.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of started defining those as the survival needs. I actually took the five levels of the hierarchy needs and I turned it into a three-level pyramid, which I called the transformation pyramid.
Okay.
Because I wanted to just simplify it. So the basic level is there's survival needs. The third and fourth level of the pyramid are these social belonging needs and esteem needs. Those are like the succeed needs for people. And then at the top of the pyramid, the idea of self-actualization is like a transformation need. So just think of everything I'm going to talk about from here forward is survival, succeed, transform as you move up the pyramid.
Okay, so survival, succeed, transform.
What's the survival need for an employee? What do you think?
Paycheck.
Yeah, exactly. The survival need for employees is their compensation, money. That's a basic motivation for any employee. Now, for some of us in the world if somebody's a CEO of a big public company makes $20 million a year,
right.
That may be a higher need also because it's actually satisfying some other things for them. But the bottom line is all employees have as a base survival need the idea of what their compensation package is. But what's curious in the business world is quite often a lot of business leaders think that that's the primary motivator and the primary reason why a person actually leaves their job.
Mm-hmm.
And the Gallup organization in that great book, First Break All the Rules, showed many years ago, maybe 10 years ago, that it's not the number one reason people leave their job. It's the fourth most likely reason a person leaves their job. The number one reason a person leaves their job is because of their relationship with their boss. So, employees join companies and they leave their boss. So if money is at the base of the pyramid, and it's frankly the least differentiating way for you to actually try to compete versus your competitors,
mm-hmm.
As you go up this pyramid, the next level, the succeed level for an employee, is when they feel recognized. So it's recognition. So you got money at the base, recognition in the middle. So recognition is what creates loyalty. People tend to be loyal to other people. They're loyal to a company too, but more importantly, they're loyal to the people they work for directly. And so creating a culture, both a informal and a formal culture of recognition is an essential piece of creating less employee turnover and a more engaged employee populace. And, I'm in the hospitality business. We have I started from being a tiny little, one property, and we now have almost 3,000 employees throughout the state of California. And what I've seen over time is, our employee turnover is 1/4 the industry average in the hospitality business. Is that because we're the highest, compensator? No, we're in fact right in the middle. We are not right at 50 percentile point. We never try to go below that, but we don't tend to actually pay at the top of the scale. So part of the reason that we have 1/4 of the turnover of the industry is because we have a lot of recognition programs. A lot of people, when they think this, think like Employee of the Month Club, which is really a relatively tired idea. And it's not a bad idea. It's certainly one thing you can do. But just having a little plaque on the wall that once a month or once a quarter is actually changed doesn't do it. And there's a lot of other things you can do. And in the book, I have a whole chapter just specifically on recognition.
What's one or two things that people can...
Yeah, let me give you one example. This is one that's so simple, any company could do it. So any organization could do it. If you have meetings, a regular meeting, it could be, if you're a small organization, it could be just a full staff meeting,
mm-hmm.
Or it could be a senior executive meeting. In our case, we had a weekly executive committee meeting. We would have 16 people in a room for 2 hours. And I can tell you in 01, 02, 03, when things were really rough, that was not a fun meeting to be at sometimes because we were talking about tough things. We would end the meeting, the two-hour meeting, with 10 minutes of recognition. Now, not recognition for each other in the room,
Yeah. But
what we would do is we would talk. Anybody in the room, any of us of the 16 executive committee members, the top people in the company, could actually bring up and recognize someone else in the company. It could be Joe the bellman at the Hotel Adagio. And let's say the Hotel Adagio elevators were out for 2 days because of some major maintenance thing. And Joe had a German tour group that had 60 bags, and he had to schlep them up 16 flights of stairs. And so the vice president of operations might bring up Joe's name and say, this is what Joe did. He'd be recognized at the executive committee level. And then someone else, let's say the vice president of technology, might then say, I will volunteer to give Joe a call or go see Joe and say thank you. And so what happens here is three things. Number one is we ended our meetings on a positive note. So it actually helped remind the senior team in the company that as bad as things are, let's talk about some things that are going well. So it ended the meetings on a good note. Number two is Joe gets recognized. And the fact is, if you create a culture of recognition, then Joe feels like, wow, he was noticed for something he did. Someone caught him doing something right as opposed to doing something wrong. Joe is going to feel better. He's going to actually go probably recognize another employee. It's, you know, there's a karmic element that happens when you have positive things, you know, sort of happening within your company. But most importantly, and this is the subtle third point that actually I really noticed in the downturn, is that when the vice president of technology, who has nothing to do with the bellman, goes to the bellman and says, hey, thank you very much. First of all, congratulations, we talked about you in our executive committee meeting, but thank you for doing this. All of a sudden, Joe in the operations department says, hey, that technology department's pretty cool. And what tends to happen in a downturn and what tends to happen with companies that grow and start having little silos of different departments is that marketing, you know, doesn't get along with operations. And operations doesn't trust the HR department. And everybody hates accounting. So you get into the place where you have these different departments that are silos, and there's a lack of trust, and there's a lot of finger-pointing. And so what we were able to do by actually just having this simple 10-minute recognition at the end of each meeting weekly was it allowed us to sort of help build bridges between different departments also.
Excellent. And so then going beyond that.
The peak of the pyramid so you is meaning. So you've got three levels here. You have money at the base level. You have recognition in the middle level, and you have meaning at the top. What I mean by meaning is when a person has a sense of inspiration in what they do every day or what the organization does. So it's almost like you could think of it the following way. A person can have one of three kinds of relationship with their work. It can either be a job, a career, or a calling.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think of those levels, job, career, calling, they relate to the three levels of the pyramid we're talking about here. So survival is about job. People who think about a job, you know, are sort of focused on the base of the pyramid. People who think of their career are focused on success, the recognition around success, how they feel appreciated for what they do. The person who's living a calling, and those of us in the world who have gone, I'm in the hotel business, if you've gone and ever checked into a hotel and someone checks you in, we call our front desk clerks hosts, because that's really what they're doing, they're hosts for the hotel. If someone checks you in and they clearly are energized by giving service, that may be their calling, and you can feel it. Just like if someone actually checks you in and you feel like a number or like an assembly line, that person maybe is living a job. The reality is companies that are very successful help to elevate their employees, whether they're, you know, employees cleaning toilets in a hotel or whether it's someone who's selling computer equipment. When you elevate that person so they move from thinking of what they do as a job to a career to a calling, what you're doing is you're getting a person much more engaged and inspired by what they do. And that sense of self-actualization and transformation at the top of the pyramid is, you know, we want to try to get as many of our employees there as possible.
Now, does that come, Chip, do you think, from a charismatic leader that has people buy into his vision or his or her vision of where they're heading, or is it from something else?
It's a variety of things, because there's a lot of organizations. One of the things I learned as we started applying these principles and seeing that they were working for us as I started looking at other companies, and there's a lot of companies out there that live the Maslow principles that don't have charismatic leaders. I mean, there's some ones that do, like, you know, Whole Foods Markets, you know, John Mackey, who's the founder there, you know, is a relatively charismatic guy in terms of at least he's got a vision and people sort of buy into his vision. But Medtronic, you know, Bill George, he's a very nice guy and he's a good speaker and he's a good writer. They can't say he's like the most charismatic guy in the world, and he really helped to elevate Medtronic, which makes pacemakers, such that during the 10 years as a public company when he was the CEO, they had the fastest growing market capitalization on Wall Street. And it was very much related to the principles of Maslow and Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Harley Davidson, I mean, I don't think a lot of us probably can't cite who the CEO of Harley Davidson's been the last 25 years.
Yeah.
But this is a company that actually was, you know, almost about to die in 1984. And the CEO, Rich Teerlink, hired a guy named Lee Osley, who was a guy who studied with Maslow for 3 years. He was an organizational development specialist who believed in the Maslow principles. And he came in 1984 when the company was about to go bankrupt and created a Maslow structure and approach to how they created culture in their company. And, of course, Harley Davidson is one of the best-known, you know, American icon stories of a company. So,
oh, yeah. I don't know too many other companies or customers would tattoo their logo.
Exactly. So let's move to the customer pyramid then, since you just brought
okay.
up customers.
All right, yeah, let's do that. So once again, moving from, I guess, survival, succeeding, and meaning then?
Survival, succeed, and transform.
Transform.
That's the same, we'll use that same principle in each one of these three pyramids. So again, the employee one was money, recognition, meaning. For the customer, the best way to think of your customer is the following way. Whether you own a dry cleaners, or you run a bar, or you own some kind of online business that's providing some kind of service to customers. Basically, customers have an expectation of what they're looking for when they actually give you the custom of their business. They actually have some expectation of what they're going to get for their money.
Mm-hmm.
And so the baseline for a customer is having their expectations met. So just meeting expectations is the base thing that a company can do, the survival need for a customer. And what that creates is customer satisfaction. So let me use an example. So Ford and General Motors and JCPenney and Sears and Montgomery Ward, these for 25 years ago, they were the icons of American business. And as companies, they did a very good job of getting to the base level of expectations of what a customer was looking for, and therefore they created a base level of customer satisfaction. But the reality is what those five companies have learned in the last 25 years is that there's a lot more competition today. And just like a company can't just focus on the survival needs of its employees and expect that their employees are going to stick around forever and be loyal, same thing with customers. Customers, especially in the online world where, your competitor is just a click away,
mm-hmm.
The fact is if you just are meeting the basic expectations of your customers, that survival need, it's not enough. And look at a company like Blockbuster. Blockbuster Video, 10 or 15 years ago, looked like they were the dominant player in video rentals. And you thought, hey, that company is never going to have a problem. And then a whole new technology came along, and Netflix sort of knocked them off their perch. And we realized very quickly that, in fact, that Blockbuster was barely meeting the expectations of the customer, but there weren't any other choices. So the next level up, the succeed level for a customer of what they're looking for, is having their desires met. So a step above having your expectations met is imagining, well, here's some tangible things I wish I could get for what I'm paying, and if I do get it, I'll be happier, and maybe I'll be even more committed to the company.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking about a hotel for a minute, since that's my business, the expectation a customer might have is that, I'm going to have a nice, clean, comfortable room. My check-in process is going to be, relatively hassle-free and quick. I'll have a room that's got the basic business things in place so I can, plug my laptop in or just plug into the Wi-Fi. Those are the basic, those are the expectations. But if all of a sudden at check-in I realize that they've upgraded me to a room with a view and I've got a balcony that I didn't even know about, or that there's a wine hour that I get a complimentary glass of wine, and I'm hanging out with a bunch of other guests and having a good conversation, and the staff actually remembers my name, those are the kinds of things that address the social belonging and esteem needs that are on the success level of the customer pyramid. Now, again, that's specific to a hotel experience, but you can think about that for any kind of customer need. What's the desire? What is it that's a step above the expectations? Because, again, you start differentiating yourself as a customer by moving up that pyramid. What's at the peak of the pyramid, the transformative nature of that self-actualized customer, is when a customer actually feels that their unrecognized needs were met. Now, that may sound like incredibly psychological.
Right. It sounds like we've got to be a mind reader.
Actually, that's interesting you say that. That is a little bit of what it is. I mean, it is being a mind reader, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have to, deeply psychologically analyze your customers. It just means you need to sort of understand what is it that they're doing that they're looking for that people are currently not offering them. So
yeah.
Fred Smith did this with FedEx when he started FedEx 30 years ago. And I love, he has a great quote, because Fred Smith started FedEx. No one had, it wasn't like customers were out saying, out there in the market saying, I need overnight delivery of packages in across America.
Mm-hmm.
He came across the idea, he figured out how to do it, and then it was an unrecognized need of the customer. Southwest Airlines did that, frankly, when they started actually making the cost of flying the same similar to cost of taking a Greyhound bus. So the process of actually addressing Jet and JetBlue, I'm using three different people who fly, but JetBlue, when they actually created the TV and the DirecTV on the back of the seat in front of you on the plane, they were addressing a very important unrecognized need that was needed to be met for customers, and that was the need that, frankly, when you're actually traveling, you feel like cattle because the process of going through the security systems can actually make you feel like you have absolutely no control at all. You're just sort of like, you're a piece of meat being let out to pasture.
Right.
And so when you go and sit in your seat at JetBlue, you actually all of a sudden have this little bit of control, and you are entertained for a five-hour flight if you're flying across the country. And that's an unrecognized need that nobody else was meeting at the time when JetBlue launched that. What I was going to say about Fred Smith, though, is that Fred Smith said a few years after Fred had actually created FedEx, and it was now starting to be very competitive in the marketplace with other overnight package deliverers. He had a famous quote, which was, "I thought I was in the business of transporting goods, and I came to realize I was in the business of peace of mind." And he came up with that quote at the point when FedEx had become a commodity. In fact, the customer had sort of moved down that pyramid from customers having their unrecognized needs met, but once you've had those met for a while, you start getting to be a place where, it becomes a desire, and then it becomes an expectation. So things sort of, like gravity takes it down.
Mm.
And what happened about 12 or 15 years ago is FedEx realized that they had become a commodity, and Fred Smith said, what people want is not just the transportation of goods, they want the peace of mind of the tracking, of knowing where the goods are. And so FedEx spent a fortune on their tracking systems and ultimately launched their sort of state-of-the-art tracking system that allowed them to move up to being, the market leader again, until such time as everybody else had a tracking system and it had moved down, and then you have to look at what's the next competitive thing that actually differentiates you. But it wasn't Fred Smith, I've heard him speak, and it was not that the customers absolutely said, here's the tracking system you need to create to make me happy.
Right.
It was actually, this is something that he could see the customers wanted, but they hadn't necessarily put it into words to say, here's how you can deliver it. So a lot of it is mind reading. A lot of it's understanding your customer and what they're missing and what they're really looking for that's going to create that loyalty.
Well, I like this quote, and once again, this is out of your book, Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow, which I definitely recommend everyone pick up, is you have a quote here that says, we want to wow our guests by delivering them experiences they hadn't even imagined.
Yeah. Well, that's actually, it's interesting. That's, what's his name? David Wegman? Wegmans is a very, very famous supermarket company based in the Northeast. And, what's that?
We just got one close to here.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, it's a fascinating company. It's, every year it's in the top five of the 100 best companies to work for in America, and it's a
grocery store.
Right. So, but what Wegman says is that they're in the business of mind reading. That's what they're in the business of doing. And so, what we started to realize in our business, at a very difficult time for us, is that we were in the business of two things. Not only are we in the business, the thing that we're obviously in the business of is actually providing accommodations for people who are spending the night.
Sure.
And creating great experiences and all that. But two things that we realized is that we're in the boutique hotel business, and boutique hotels tend to be a little bit smaller than chain hotels. They're more personalized, a little more stylish, things like that. What we came to realize is that people would choose their boutique hotel based upon the way the hotel made them feel about themselves. It's almost like the hotel is a mirror for their aspirations for how they see themselves. So we started to really realize that we needed to play up the idea that by staying in one of our hotels, it could create what we call an identity refreshment. So if you're staying in a hotel that is sort of artistic and literate and sophisticated and worldly, when you check out 3 days later, this place makes you feel more of those words. Or, you know, we're all very familiar with sort of the hip boutique hotels. If you're staying at a hip, in-the-know, beautiful, avant-garde hotel, maybe you feel more of those words. So what we started to realize is every single one of our hotels could be based upon a magazine as sort of a touchstone, whether it's Rolling Stone or New Yorker. And that could be our way of getting clear on what are the five words that define the hotel and how do we actually, in creating those hotels, make sure the customer feels that sense of identity refreshments as if they're in their ideal habitat. And the second thing we realized that was an unrecognized need of our customers was that all of our hotels are in California. And so we realized that if I'm traveling to California or if I'm traveling to Los Angeles or San Francisco and I've actually never been there before, I don't want to go out and get a farmer's guide that just tells me all the things to know about San Francisco. I actually want to talk to a friend who lives in San Francisco who knows me, who can actually recommend what are the things that are sort of the hidden treasures there that are things that I would like to see that fit my personality. So our website does that. In essence, on our website, we have this character named Yvette, the hotel matchmaker, and she just gives you a one-minute personality test, and we get a clear sense of your psychographic and the five words that describe you, and we give back to you the hotel. We say, here are the hotels in our collection that fit your personality, but most importantly, here's a bunch of travel content and a couple of locals who are very similar to you, who live in San Francisco or Los Angeles or Napa or wherever, and they're going to tell you what to do because they're so similar to you, and they're going to tell you what are the great things, you know, to do in that area. So it was this almost like creating this very mass customized, personalized approach to travel advice, which is not something that our customers were asking for, but it's clearly been successful for us because the amount of revenues we get from our guests through our website is like way above the industry average, and that's partly by delivering that.
What's the site that people can check out?
It's so the company's called Joie de Vivre, but the site is just jdvhotels.com.
JDV Hotels. Okay.
Yeah, so if you go on the homepage, you'll see Yvette, the hotel matchmaker, and you can see that you can actually choose your hotel based upon personality, and you'll see what the results are.
I know you spent a lot of time on your web strategies and differentiating them from other hotels and doing all this, so it's definitely a model that people can check out and maybe learn a little bit from. So coming up with our own sort of, I don't know, customer pyramid,
mm-hmm.
or trying to get to this peak experience to the top of the pyramid, what are some of the keys that you would say help you get there?
Well, I think that, again, if you think survival, succeed, and then transform. And it's funny, I'm in YPO, and I was at a YPO meeting yesterday with my forum, and there's a guy in our group who's a really big-time branding specialist. He
mm-hmm.
owns a branding company, and he was working with CNET, which is based in San Francisco, that owns a bunch of different companies, and they were using the pyramid to actually define what differentiates them. And so what they realized is that what's at the base of the pyramid is really how you make sure that you are not behind your competitors. It's the survival element that if you aren't doing some of these things, you will be competitively disadvantaged versus your competitors.
It could be online booking if you're a hotel.
Yeah, exactly. Good example. But frankly, online booking, let's say 8 years ago, that would not have been the baseline. That would not have been a survival thing. That would have been maybe a desire. And at some point, 12 years ago, maybe it might have been, you know, top of the pyramid.
Right.
So, or just even having internet access in your guest room. Again, mm-hmm. that is
I remember when I was traveling, and it was like an exciting thing for me to be able to plug in somewhere.
But now Wi-Fi
was like awesome.
Now it's an expectation. So
exactly.
So I think that, you know, thinking about what are those things that your customers, if they didn't have them, it doesn't matter what you're doing above that, you're going to be in trouble. And that's why a lot of people have read the book, and they've really gravitated with what's at the top of the pyramid, which is great. But there's also a message here, which is that if you don't get the foundation of your pyramid right, the stuff you do at the top of the pyramid may be irrelevant. If when you're staying in one of our hotels at 2 in the morning and you love everything about the hotel and it fits like it's your habitat, but if at 2 in the morning every night the plumbing bangs uncontrollably so you can't sleep, we have not gotten your survival needs right. So you got to make sure that, you know, if you have an online site, if you're an online company, make sure that the technology works well. I mean, that's sort of a basic. But as you move up that pyramid, the next step is, you know, how do you actually, in the case of CNET just said, okay, the baseline survival is we're going to give you a lot of information so you can learn a lot. The mid level is, you know, we're going to actually teach you how this information is relevant to you. And how you can make it sort of like, oh, this is a little bit more personalized. But then at the top of the pyramid, they sort of felt like it has a lot to do with how the experience of using the site in terms of CNET, how it actually makes a person feel about themselves. So it actually sort of a little bit goes back to the reflection. Just like, you know, some people are very evangelistic about being an Apple customer, because it makes them feel independent. Some others, you know, Harley-Davidson customers feel rebellious. Patagonia customers feel like they are, you know, or Whole Foods Market customers feel like they are, you know, sustainability-driven, and that makes them feel good. So a lot of times what's up higher up the pyramid is a little bit intangible, but it has an awful lot to do with how you're allowing your customer to express themselves by being a customer with your company.
Well, something you mentioned and maybe you can touch on a little bit is when Fred Smith from FedEx said that they're in the business of peace of mind, of making sure that that people's packages got there the next day. So I think a pretty important question to ask yourself is, what business are you in?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. It's a Peter Drucker question from many years ago. Peter Drucker said, you know, it's the most important question any company can ask itself. What business are you in? And I have an exercise in the book. chapter 9 in the book is about the unrecognized needs of a customer.
Mm-hmm.
I have a series of exercises at the end of each chapter, and there's a question that says, sit down with your senior execs or even with line-level employees and ask them that same question, what business are you in, 5 times. Ask them once and then let them answer. And, of course, the first time they answer, like in the hotel business,
right,
the first answer might be, you know, we're in the business of taking care of people far away from home. Okay.
Yeah.
Ask the question again, what business are you in? And each time you ask that question, what it will do is it will help your people get more to the essence of what it is that you're doing. And generally speaking, that will allow you to get clearer on what can differentiate you, because it will allow you to focus on some of the intangibles of what it is. You know, the fact that in our business we've moved from being in the business of just lodging people, you know, accommodating people, to
right,
the idea that we're actually refreshing their identity helped us start looking at some of the things that we do, both in the marketing of our hotels, but also in terms of the delivery of services and experiences that we know are going to give people a sense of identity refreshment.
How do you know when you're on the right track with the business that you're in? I mean, I could ask that for you, and you could say, well, I'm in the business of hospitality, and I think that you're on the right track, and we go with that.
Well, do you mean how do I, you know it based upon the questions, or how do you know your business is on the right track?
No, how do you know if you're on the right track with that question of what business you're in?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, first of all, if you're doing it with multiple people, you'll start seeing people sort of gravitate to it and say, yeah, that's it. I mean, it's sort of like a discovery that all of a sudden becomes sort of a collective consciousness of the people in the room. So that could be part of it. Understand that, generally speaking, what's at the base of Maslow's pyramid, your physiological needs, are very tangible, and everybody can touch them. You know, if you didn't have lunch today and it's 3 p.m, you can feel it. It's tangible. If you weren't self-actualized today, it's not all that tangible. But what's interesting in life, as MasterCard has said in their commercials, is what's most important in life is what's priceless. And that's what's priceless is what's at the peak of the pyramid. It's the intangible stuff. So it isn't easy figuring this out, because if it was, there'd be no differentiation between you and your other competitors, because it's the basics. But it's when people actually figure out that aha moment that actually sets them apart, that actually people are able to create that market share growth. And you know you're getting it right when, frankly, you start creating a much more evangelical customer base.
Right.
And some of that has to do with how much do you advertise. You know, if your business has been around a while and you're still advertising a lot, there's something wrong with your business model.
Interesting, because it's not driven by word of mouth. And
right, right. I mean, we're a $250 million a year company, and we spend less than $50,000 a year on advertising. Now, that's on print advertising. We do spend some money on online stuff, obviously, and we have some salespeople and things like that. But for our competitors that would be comparably sized that have $250 million in sales, probably spend somewhere about 1% of their total revenues, so $2.5 million on advertising. We spend $50,000. So there's a big difference, and that says that something else is going on here.
Yeah, no, that's pretty impressive for sure. Well, maybe one of the things, and I definitely want to get your take on this, is what you guys do differently. You mentioned it before. You call your front desk attendants hosts.
Right.
You've talked about identity refreshment. So give me a little bit about the vocabulary, the terms you guys use, and how that you think affects everything that you're doing here with Peak Experiences.
Well, the language you use tells the people who you work with what's important, and how you're sort of positioning something. And the hotel business for many years was known for their front desk clerks. That's who is actually at the front desk checking you in and checking you out. When you call someone a clerk, you're in essence saying you are administrative in your function. You're in the business of making sure that you do a transaction. And I think the best leaders in the business world are those that move from transactional leaders to transformative leaders. They sort of move up that pyramid. So the idea that our front desk clerks could realize that, yes, in fact, checking someone in, checking someone out, making sure you have their credit card is a piece of what you're doing, but it is not what differentiates you in your experience of being an employee here. And it's certainly not what differentiates you from the customer's perspective. So the idea of just starting to call our front desk clerks hosts, front desk hosts, was the first step we took about 12 or 14 years ago to sort of say, hey, we don't want you to be a clerk. We want you to be a host, because that's what happens when you have someone over to your home and you have someone over for dinner. You're hosting them. That's what we want you to feel like here. Now, here's the risk about changing language.
Mm-hmm.
And during the dot-com era, it was, I live in San Francisco. We have a lot of hotels in Silicon Valley. And everybody during the dot-com era in the Bay Area was changing the names of everybody else in the company because it was the clever thing to do. Just changing the name of a title of someone is not enough. It's not enough because it can be just marketing BS. So it has to actually come with it some reality in terms of a change in training, a change in perspective, a change in scope of work of what the person does. Generally speaking, here's a thought that is, I think, very interesting that I learned as I was reading a lot of books and doctoral theses when I was writing the book. I did a lot of reading. When employees actually move from looking at the task of what they do to looking at the purpose impact it has on the customer, it actually moves them from thinking of just what they do as being a job to being a calling. And if you think about like a nurse, if a nurse thinks of themselves as a patient advocate, because there's been two studies that have shown this, when a nurse thinks of themselves as a patient advocate, as opposed to the person who creates pain with the syringe,
right,
which is an alternative way of looking at a person's role as a nurse, it actually gives them a much broader perspective of what their role is. They're moving from task to impact. When we did an exercise with our housekeeping staff, we have 1,200 housekeepers in our company, and they clean toilets for a living. So we did an exercise with seven of them at a table in a whole big room with lots of other facilitators, and we asked them the question after a little bit of warm up exercises: what if a Martian came down here and didn't know that you were called a maid or a room cleaner or a housekeeper? And they saw what you did for them overnight, just in terms of taking care of the room and all the elements of what you do. What would they call you? What would they, what job title would they call you? And in the course of the, half hour that we brainstormed with them, we got everything from I'm the mom away from home, to we're the peace of mind police, to we're the clutter busters, or because most of them are women, someone said, we're the serenity sisters. We create serenity, when someone comes back to their room. they have this sort of sense of serenity that someone's taking care of everything for them. So, and so we did that, and then we actually had an exercise where we had five customers come in and talk to all these housekeeping staff about experiences they had at as a customer that actually were incredibly meaningful for them as a customer, that really touched them in some way. So by actually helping our housekeeping staff, people who clean toilets for a living, to move beyond just, okay, the fact that I clean a toilet, to the idea that, you know, I have a broader perspective of what I'm doing here, and I've actually heard how it impacts the customer. What happened over the next year after we did that exercise is our employee turnover in the housekeeping staff company-wide, which was already really low, got cut in half. And our customer satisfaction scores around both everything from cleanliness to just friendliness of the housekeeping staff went up, so it was actually at the world-class standard for the company that actually does our surveys. So it was, we were competing with the Four Seasons of the world in terms of how we were actually, and we can measure it from exactly the time we had, you know, 700 of those 1,200 housekeepers in a day-long retreat we did with them. So the stuff works if you, but it's not just about changing the title.
Yeah, that's a great example. Now, after that exercise, was there a title change, or is it still,
you know,
for housekeepers?
For the housekeepers, it's still, you know, a lot of our we take over hotels that are unionized quite often. So interestingly enough, the union doesn't want us to change titles. It's a strange element, but you know, they don't want us to change titles. So we work with the titles that they in those cases where there's an existing title, we have to work with those. In the cases where we have non-union hotels, which is a lot of our hotels also, we have changed titles.
What are the maids called?
Well, it depends on the some hotels actually, and that one it's from hotel to hotel. Some of them are called room attendants. In one particular hotel, they are called the Serenity Sisters, because all the staff there is in fact housekeeping staff is women, so it varies from hotel to hotel on that one.
Great. Okay, let's move on to the third group real fast.
Yeah.
Investors.
This one's I'm going to be brief on just because a lot of the people who are listening may not have investors.
Right.
But the reality is, it was the most interesting of the three pyramids to come up with, because in some ways, the question was, if this is all about humanity and how do you focus on human needs for employees and customers, the question was, are investors human? It's
right.
A very relevant question. And I found that they are, and I have a lot of investors who've done a lot of our hotels with us. And the three levels basically are, most of the investor world are just focused on the bottom line, and they are transactionally focused. And so the base survival need is transactional alignment. You as an entrepreneur or a company need to have transactional alignment, be aligned with your investors in terms of what the basic definition is of the business plan and of what you're going to try to execute on. That's the foundation of the pyramid. But the reality is that, again, is just a survival need, and what differentiates a company or an entrepreneur is having a relationship, and that's the second level, is the relationship alignment. When you're aligned with an investor on a relationship level, you have a much more likelihood to have a longer-term relationship with that investor. It's frankly the difference between milk and a cow. Investors who are focused purely on the milk are focused on the base of the pyramid. They just want return on investment as fast as quickly. You know, give me as much milk as you can. And investors that are smarter and realize that milk just doesn't come from anywhere, it comes from a cow, and they better treat the cow well, realize that they get better long-term returns and more deals and things like that because they create a relationship alignment. The
what
peak of that
investors into a fillet and is that a
the peak of that pyramid is legacy investors. Having a relationship that's almost like a mission-aligned relationship, having an alignment of mission with an investor. And it doesn't have to just be a socially responsible investor, but it could be someone who just says that, you know, they feel a bit transformed by the fact that they've invested with you or your company. And it could be because they feel like they're helping you as an entrepreneur. It could be because they love the product and they think it's going to change an industry. It could be because of socially responsible reasons in terms of, you know, making a difference in the world. So that's the peak of the pyramid. That's the kind of investor that, generally speaking, is most likely to give loyalty to a company or an entrepreneur.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. I think you and I might have emailed about this, but I'm scheduled to go up on the Virgin Galactic deal.
Right.
So I'm number, I think, 152. I might have moved up recently.
Wow.
But, So you have to put down a pretty sizable investment or deposit,
mm-hmm.
and you're essentially funding the whole process. And 2 weeks ago, I was at the unveiling of Spaceship Two, and it really went beyond just space tourism, sending up a bunch of guys and gals to go look at the Earth, to more of the entire, you know, being that the Earth can't sustain the amount of people that are coming in the next 20, 30 years, and the colonization of space and unmanned space probes. And so it really went beyond just space tourism, and that's a perfect example of I'm essentially an investor in Virgin Galactic,
yeah.
using my money to fund a lot of it. And now the fact that I feel like I'm a pioneer and part of something way bigger really puts me into that, or that feeling of...
It creates pride of ownership. I mean,
yeah.
that's really, you know, when, if the top of the employee pyramid creates inspiration in an employee, the peak of the customer pyramid creates evangelistic customers who have huge word of mouth, and the peak of the investor pyramid creates that sense of legacy investor, creates a pride of ownership, that they just, you know, they see that by, they feel somewhat transformed by the investment they've made. And it's not just about return on investment exclusively, although again, in many cases, that's still an important foundation to the relationship.
Yeah, excellent. In the last couple minutes that we got here, talk about how have you used peak experiences maybe in your personal life beyond business? Has that affected?
Well, I'll give you a couple examples. I'll tell you one that relates to business but was also very personal is we have a funny name of this company, Joie de Vivre. It's, you know, how do you spell
right.
it? How do you pronounce it? You know, et cetera. It's not particularly practical. That's why the website's JDV Hotels.
Right.
And people say JDV all the time. Well, one of the great things about the name of the company is that it means something. It means joy of life, and for people who get what it means, they get that we're different. And we had a 20th anniversary party last year, and we decided to create a peak experience for a collection of people who weren't our customers. There are 10,000 women in the state of California. Again, we're just a California company. We're the largest hotelier in California now.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a collection of women named Joy, and there are 10,000 of them in the state of California. We invited them all to a party. We had a Joy party, and so the intent was, of course, there was marketing benefit and there was PR about it,
sure.
but part of it really came down to the idea that there's this collection of women around the state, all of whom have an emotion as their name, and a particularly interesting emotion, and one that's relevant to our company based upon the name of the company and what we try to create. So we invited them all to a party. Now, of course, not all 10,000 came, but 150 did. And we had 150 Joys in a room in San Francisco, and we had a Joy party. And it was the most fascinating experience, because whether they were 75-year-old women or 14-year-old women, they came and they had common experiences to talk about their name. And there were, you know, lots of tears of joy. And so we, in essence, created a peak experience for other people. And
sure.
Did that have great marketing benefit? Yes, it did, of course. And they're still telling friends, and we're still getting letters. And but we didn't have to do it. In terms of peak experiences for myself, every 5 years I do a big birthday party. And whether I have a lot of money or I don't, because there's times like after 9/11 when I didn't have any money. But I'll throw a big birthday party somewhere in the world as a celebration just of bringing friends together. And the last one was in Marrakesh, Morocco, and the next one's going to probably be in, you know, Rio de Janeiro. And it's just intended to just sort of make a point that every 5 years it's nice to connect with, whether people I grew up with or people I went to business school with or current friends, to just come together and have a good time. And so
that's pretty cool. I have a big birthday coming up next year. I need some ideas.
Yeah,
that's I like that. So you just decide on a place, invite people that are meaningful to you, and
yeah, exactly. And it's a wide variety of people, and I pay for some things, but most people, you know, have to pay their way to get there and pay their hotel, and I pay for some of the parties. And but it doesn't have to be quite that elaborate. I mean, a peak experience could, you know, on a weekly basis, just say, hey, you know, let's make a rule for myself, especially when you're in a rough place, and a lot of people right now are, as they're going into an economy that, you know, they have some concerns about. You know, if you just made a rule with yourself that once a week I create a peak experience for myself, something that just is, you know, a meaningful experience that gives me a sense that I lose track of time and I sort of fall into the zone of enjoying, you know, whether it's going for a run on the beach, whether it's doing macrame, whether it's you know, going to an art film, you know, with, you know, your honey. The idea of being able to go out and have a peak experience occasionally in your life, and knowing that it's that important enough so you schedule it, you know, it's some good advice.
That's cool. That's great. That's a good place to end it, I think. Any aside from the book, which I highly recommend, as I've stated before, people should grab that, I guess, at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or
yeah,
local bookstores.
Yeah, it's still, I mean, it's been out for, it's third printing. It's been out for about 4 or 5 months, and it's still in bookstores, in many bookstores, but probably the most reliable place to get it is Amazon, I would guess.
Yeah, so it's, once again, it's called Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow. Author is Chip Conley. And anywhere else you want to send people?
Well, there's the JDV Hotels site, and then if you want to learn more about the book and just some of the philosophies in it, there's chipconley.com, and that's all one word, and Conley is spelled C-O-N-L-E-Y, chipconley.com. I'm actually teaching a weekend-long workshop in Big Sur in April, and so
anybody who
wants to come to that, welcome to, and that site has just a bunch of other information on it, too.
Is that on chipconley.com?
It is. It's under,
okay,
there's a place where it says Peak Workshops.
Oh, very good. Well, I'll have to keep doing those. I might have to check out one of those.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, Chip, really appreciate you taking the time.
Yes, very much. Thank you, Yannick. And I wish the best to everybody out there.
Thanks very much.
All right.
Talk to you soon.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.